The ignored confessions. Only an understanding of the techniques and applications of mind control could begin to bring meaning to the fragmented ramblings of Jack Ruby. On June 7, 1964, Jack Ruby was questioned in jail in Dallas, Texas by Earl Warren and Gerald Ford. In that session, Ruby continually pleaded for a lie detector test or for sodium pentothal. He desperately wanted to prove his honesty so Warren and the commission would know he was telling the truth. Said Ruby, quote, "I would like to be able to get to a lie detector test or truth serum of what motivated me to do what I did at that particular time. And it seems as you get further into something, even though you know what you did, it operates against you somehow, brainwashes you, that you are weak in what you want to tell the truth about and what you want to say, which is the truth." As I started to trial, Ruby continued, "I don't know if you realize my reasoning, how I happened to be involved. I was carried away tremendously emotionally, and all the time I tried to ask Mr. Belly, Melvin Belly, Ruby's first lawyer, I wanted to get up and say the truth regarding the steps that led me to do what I have gotten involved in. But since I have a spotty background in the nightclub business, I should have been the last person to ever want to do something that I had been involved in. In other words, I was carried away tremendously. You want to ask me questions?" Warren asked Ruby to just tell us what you want and then we'll ask you some questions. "Am I boring you?" Ruby replied. He pleaded with Warren to be taken to Washington where he could be questioned in safety. Possibly either his control agent was in the room or Ruby felt that he was, for again and again, he hinted to Warren that he had something quite important to say about, but could not say it at the moment in Dallas. "Gentlemen, unless you get me to Washington, you can't get a fair shake out of me. If you understand my way of talking, you have to bring me up to Washington to get the tests. Do I sound dramatic? Off the beam?" "No, you are speaking very, very rationally," Warren replied, "and I am really surprised you can remember as much as you have remembered up to the present time. You have given it to us in great detail." Again, Ruby pleaded with Warren, "Unless you can get me to Washington, I am not a crackpot. I have all my senses. I don't want to evade any crime I'm guilty of." Then Ruby asked that the sheriff and the law enforcement officers leave the room. And after they were gone, he said, "Gentlemen, if you want to hear any further testimony, you'll have to get me to Washington soon, because it had something to do with you, Chief Warren. Do I sound sober enough to tell you this?" "Yes, go right ahead," Warren said. "I would like to talk to you in private," Ruby told him. Warren seemed to miss the importance of Ruby's statement. "You may do that when you finish your story. You may tell me that phase of it. I bet you haven't had a witness like me in your whole investigation. Is that correct?" Ruby asked. "There are many witnesses whose memory has been as good as yours. I tell you that honestly," Warren replied. "My reluctance to talk," Ruby went on, "you haven't had any witnesses telling me the story and finding so many problems. You have a greater problem than any witness we have had," Warren retorted. "I have a lot of reasons for having those problems," Ruby explained. Then after another exchange about going immediately to Washington, Ruby said, "Gentlemen, my life is in danger here. Not with my guilty plea of execution. Do I sound sober enough to you as I say this?" Warren assured him he did sound sober. "From the moment I started my testimony, haven't I sounded as though, with the exception of becoming emotional, haven't I sounded as though I made sense what I was speaking about?" Ruby said. "You have indeed," Warren again assured him. "I understand everything you have said. If I haven't, it is my fault." "Then I follow you up with this," Ruby blurted out. "I may not live tomorrow to give any further testimony. The reason why I add this is because you assure me that I have been speaking sense, that I might be speaking sense by following what I have said, and the only thing I want to get out to the public, and I can say that here it is, with authenticity, my sincerity of the truth, of everything, and why my act was committed, but it can't be said here." "It can be said, it's got to be said amongst people with the highest authority that would give me the benefit of the doubt. And following that, immediately give me the lie detector test after I do make the statement." "Chairman Warren, if you felt your life was in danger at the moment, how would you feel? Wouldn't you be reluctant to go on speaking, even though you request me to do so? Warren again reassured Ruby that he was making perfect sense. I wish that our beloved President Lyndon Johnson would have developed deeper into the situation. Hear me, not to accept just circumstantial facts about my guilt or innocence, and have a question to find out the truth about me before he relinquished certain powers to these certain people. Consequently, a whole new form of government is going to take over our country, and I know I won't live to see you another time. Do I sound sort of screwy in telling you these things? No, Warren said. I think that is what you should believe, and you wouldn't tell under the truth. But it is a very serious situation, Ruby said. I guess it's too late to stop it, isn't it? Now maybe something could be saved. It may be too late. Whatever happens, if our President Lyndon Johnson knew the truth for me. But if I am eliminated, there won't be any way of knowing. Right, now, when I leave your presence now, I am the only one that can bring out the truth to our president, who believes in righteousness and justice. But he has been told, I am certain, that I was part of a plot to assassinate the president. I know your hands are tied. You are helpless. Earl Warren said, Mr. Ruby, I think I can say this to you, that he has been told under such thing, there is no indication of any kind that he believes it. When it became apparent that Warren did not realize Ruby had intended to confess to being a part of a plot to kill President Kennedy, Ruby exploded. I'm sorry, Chief Justice Warren. I thought I would be very effective in telling you what I have said here. But in all fairness to everyone, maybe all I want to do is beg that if they found out I was telling the truth, maybe they can succeed in what their motives are, but maybe my people won't be tortured and mutilated. Warren could find no meaning in Ruby's testimony. He merely assured him that neither he nor his family would be tortured or mutilated by anyone. You may be sure of that, the Chief Justice added. No, Ruby answered. The only way you can do it is if he knows the truth that I am telling the truth and why I was down in that basement Sunday morning, and maybe some sense of decency will come out and they can still fulfill their plan, as I stated before, without my people going through torture and mutilation. Warren assured Ruby that the president would know everything he had said. But I won't be around, Chief Justice, Ruby said. I won't be around, Chief Justice. Ruby said, I won't be around to tell the president. Then one of the aides asked the first intelligent question of the day. Why do you think is going to eliminate you and who? Jack? Ruby replied, I haven't been used for a purpose, and there will be a certain tragic occurrence happening if you don't take my testimony and somehow vindicate me so my people don't suffer because of what I have done. Jack Ruby was subsequently given a polygraph test, which proved to be inconclusive due to high levels of stress. In 1965, syndicated columnist Dorothy Killigan interviewed Ruby in Dallas in his cell. She was the only major journalist allowed to interview him. She told a few friends that from what Ruby had told her, she was able to obtain evidence which would blow the JFK case sky high. Within a few days, Dorothy Killigan died of a massive overdose of barbiturates combined with alcohol. Her apartment was found in shambles. The transcripts of her interview with Ruby were missing. Her death was ruled a suicide. In early 1967, Ruby complained he was being poisoned. He was diagnosed as having cancer, but a few weeks after complaining of being poisoned, he died not of cancer, but of a stroke similar to the one that had killed David Ferre. Another deathbed confession supports what Jack Ruby was trying to tell the Warren Commission. That confession was made by Professor George D. Moshitz, a former intelligence agency who was also a friend of Lee Harvey Oswald. D. Moshitz was born in 1911 in the Ukraine. Following the revolution in 1921, he and his parents fled Russia for Poland. He attended a Polish military academy for a year, and later, in 1938, received a doctorate in international commerce. He immigrated to the United States soon thereafter, and in 1945 and 1949 became a citizen. After becoming interested in the exploration and generation of oil, Demosthenes received his master's degree in petroleum engineering. Sometimes thereafter, he became acquainted with right-wing oil magnate H.L. Hunt. Although the basis of their relationship is unknown, De M, in an interview with Dutch journalist Wilhelm Altman, stated, "I knew Hunt, now the late Mr. Hunt, intimately. For some 20 years, I was invited to his parties." FBI disclosure in 1976 suggested Lee Harvey Oswald was also acquainted with Hunt, and De M knew Oswald. Apparently, he had introduced himself to Oswald after hearing about him through a Russian-speaking group in Dallas-Fort Worth area. Marina Oswald told the Warren Commission, "Lee did not have any close friends, but at least he had here in America. He had a great deal of respect for DM. He considered him to be a smart, to be full of joy of living, a very sympathetic person." It was the conclusion of the Warren Commission, after extensive investigation, that DM had exhibited no signs of subversive or disloyal conduct. The Warren report stated, "Neither the FBI, CIA, nor any witness contacted me. The commission has provided any information linking DM to subversive or extremist organization, nor has there been any evidence linking them in any way with the assassination of President Kennedy." It was subsequently revealed, however, that DM had also been associated with various intelligence agencies and operations over the years. He was connected with French intelligence during World War II and was also linked to CIA during the Bay of Pigs operation. In late March 1977, DM's name was brought before the newly formed House Select Committee on Assassinations. Wilhelm Altmans told the committee that DM held the key to the Kennedy assassination, that DM had privately confessed to him that prior to the assassination, he was aware of a conspiracy to murder the president in Dallas. According to the Altmans, DM was about to reveal and have a book published which would explain the details of his knowledge of the assassination. After Altman's testimony, a spokesman for the House Committee on Assassinations said the committee would investigate his claims and would, if warranted, track down DM for questioning. He was located a week later in Palm Beach, Florida, but he could not be called to testify. George DM was found dead, the victim of a gunshot wound in the head. Local officials termed his death a suicide. Following DM's death, his Dallas attorney, Pat Russell, supported Altman's claims to be the commission. He verified the fact that before his death, DM had insisted that persons other than Lee Harvey Oswald had participated in the slaying of President Kennedy. The attorney revealed that he had in his possession tapes, a book-length manuscript, and a photograph which DM had turned over to him earlier. He said the tapes were consisted of 10 reels of interviews which DM about the Kennedy assassination, which he claimed were first-hand accounts of the late professor's recollections of Oswald. Russell said, although he did not know if the tapes or the book contained any new evidence, the photograph should be particular interest in assassination investigators. He claimed that although the photo was similar to a well-known picture obtained by Dallas police, which showed Lee Harvey Oswald holding a rifle and wearing a pistol, what made the photograph interesting was it was autographed on the back of Oswald and dated May 4, 1963, approximately 6 months prior to the assassination. After DM's death, Wilhelm Altman released a portion of his interview with the deceased. Altman's described him as Oswald's most intimate friend, and without offering any explanation, said he had been intimate with Oswald during 3 years when Oswald's brain was being programmed toward the murder of the century. In the interview dated February 23, 1977, DM told Altman's, "In June 1976, I completed a manuscript. That's when a disaster struck, you see. In the book, I played the devil's advocate. Without directly implicating myself as an accomplice in the JFK assassination, I still mentioned a number of names, particularly of FBI and CIA officials, who apparently may not be exposed under any circumstances. I was drugged surreptitiously, and as a result, I was committed to a mental hospital. I was there 8 weeks and was given electric shocks, and as a consequence, I sometimes forget certain details temporarily." DM went on to say that as a result of the drugs and shocks, he could take no more. I tried to commit suicide 5 times. One of these days, I will put a revolver to my head. According to the Altmans, DM left Dallas in the middle of the night on March 3, 1977, telling him, "I don't want anybody to see me." Altmans reported that at the time, DM was in a state of panic, constantly worried whether they would let him leave the country. "He always felt watched and followed," Altman said. "I really cannot see how somebody who does have not anything to put his would develop such behavior like this." On the day he died, George DM was being interviewed by Arthur Edward J. Epstein for his book, The Legend of Lee Harvey Oswald. They broke for lunch at 1 o'clock, and Epstein walked DM to his car. They were supposed to resume the interview at 3 p.m., and when M didn't return, Epstein called his room and heard a distraught maid tell him that DM had taken his own life. DM's daughter, Alexandra, told Epstein she believes her father took his own life after he had a post-hypnotic suggestion triggered by a voiceover and the telephone in the room. The last days of George DM sound strikingly similar to those of the victims of mind control. Could it have been that when drugs and electric shock failed to erase his memory, the final solution was self-described or self-prescribed? Or is it programmed to self-destruct? Ukraine-born George DM, oilman, friend of right-wing billionaire H. Hunt, took a phone call at his hotel room, put the phone down, and fatally shot himself. DM told a reporter that he had not been drugged, committed to a mental hospital, and given electric shocks by CIA and FBI officials, and he knew who was involved in the assassination of President JFK. His daughter believes he took his life acting upon a post-hypnotic suggestion and implanted by the cryptocracy.